The SGGQA podcast is brought to you in part by Me Audio. So here's the deal. If you've ever seen me in a live stream or in an interview or some other kind of video, you've probably seen me wearing some fancy earbuds. For the last couple years, my work buds have been almost exclusively from Me Audio. Excellent drivers, fantastic accessories, and both my wife and I had our ears scanned by the folks at Me Audio for custom molded ear tips. Super comfy. The MX line of Pro in-ear monitors is one of the easiest lineups to understand, starting at $60 and built around actual professional use. Detailed sound and durable construction, but also with some fun options like customizable faceplates. Even if you're not working on stage or in studio, Pro solutions like these are fantastic audio options, and they don't need to break the bank. And the company also supports a lineup of consumer gear with options for true wireless and noise-canceling Bluetooth earbuds, adapters for TVs to stream your audio to nicer headphones, and headsets for kids to help control the volume on fresh, developing ears. I can't stress that last one enough. We have to start kids out with healthier listening habits. It's a great combo, high-quality audio gear built by a team of folks with recording-grade use in mind, but at consumer-friendly prices. But of course, I can do you one better. If you shop the kit at meaudio.com and use promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, you can save an additional 10% over their already competitive prices. Once again, meaudio.com, M-E-E-audio.com. Shop some fun kit, promo code SOMEGADGETGUY at checkout, 10% off. Keep your ears and your wallet happy at the same time. I want to thank the folks at Me Audio for hooking up the promo code. Now, let's get on with the show.
All right. I believe this means we are live. There we go. I'm real good at what I do. The show is always the utmost of professionalism, and I am good at camera-ing. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, tech fans of all shapes and sorts and sizes and persuasions, welcome to another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SGGQA podcast channel. I'm Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy, as we're going to be breaking down the top tech news stories of the last week, free of annoying leaks and rumors. No iPhone 14 here, no Galaxy S22 there. We've got some actual stuff that we can kind of actually really talk about, like tech in news, tech in politics, and then I can share some of my credit card bill woes as we look forward to eventually going hands-on with some real expensive products coming up. He has a face. Oh, ball. It's like every week. So I mean, just to let you know, like every episode of this podcast, I add something that makes the plumbing more complicated, from advanced microphone modeling and noise cancellation to image tracking, different cameras, different plugins, different ways to route all of this stuff. And, it's always like getting into the last minute of the pre-show. Who knows what's going to work? So, everybody, I hope you had a fantastic weekend, had a little downtime, a little time to unplug. I'm very tongue-in-cheeky this week when it comes to the title of this podcast and some of the frustrations that I've had in some of this tech commentary. I think we've seen very clear evidence of just, like, the hype machine, the hype train that needs to be built to sustain a lot of our favorite gadget commentary, and it's built on this whole notion of novelty, that as soon as the product is actually available to average consumers, that product is now a dead topic. You know, once the normies can talk about it, well, we tech enthusiasts need to move on to the next rumor, and that's kind of a bummer. So I've got some fun stuff that's going to be coming up on the channel, some really cool... I got to be careful because I'm on two embargoes right now, so I got to be very selective about what I say, but we're going to have some really interesting things to talk about that are not just rumors and leaks. And so especially for this podcast, kind of leading into this whole week of crazy production that I'm going to be jumping on, I think we'll have some fun. We're gonna have King Turtle 2004. What are your thoughts on the redacted and redacted leaks and rumors? I missed the slash S in the live chat. I was like, oh no, is there something? Is there big news? I was just being a jerk talking about, you know, no leaks and rumors. So we've got a really heavy news block, but I kind of liked the flow of the show from last week. So I'm going to try and condense news block a little bit more. And then gadget block, we can kind of open it up just for a chill chat. I did a live stream after the Surface event where I just sort of rambled through my reactions. I've had a little bit more time to kind of put together the things that I think are exciting and the things that I'm concerned about for the Duo 2. But, you know, I put some money down on that phone, and that thing's crazy expensive. And so then, you know, especially as we get to the end of this, if we have a little room for a bit more Q&A, we can definitely build that into. So why don't we knock out housekeeping real quick? Everything that we're going to be talking about, all of the links, all of the articles, all of the news stories, everything's going to be available on the show notes for this week's episode, somegadgetguy.com. And like I said, I'm on embargo for some gear. These are going to be reviews that I am crazy excited to share with you, getting hands-on, getting a sneak peek at what's coming down the pipe. It's also some stuff that's a little fresh for this channel from companies that I really haven't worked with in the past. And so I had to kind of front load a lot of extra work. So this last week was actually a little lean for the finished produced reviews. I was doing a lot of podcasting. I was doing a lot of pre-pro. I was doing a lot of prep. Definitely got my step counts for a number of days last week just for, you know, walking around and testing stuff out. So one of the major stories that I got out, it was also under embargo. I got to go hands-on with a company that I really enjoy. Oh, no. See, again, it's I'm real good at the live streaming. Hold on. I've got to add this to here. Now Firefox will switch over. Now I can go back here. And now I can, let's see if it'll let me pull the live chat back out. There we go. Doing it live, folks. We're doing it live. OBS gets real dumb when you have multiple browsers open. And I forgot to prioritize the browser that has all of my links and show info. So, one more Color Buds. I got to spend some time with the newest refresh of the smallest earbuds from One More. And this is a nice little refresh where for $80 before coupon codes, you can grab yourself some of the smallest true wireless earbuds available. They support Qualcomm Adaptive, which is going to be the new flavor of the sort of aptX codecs that Qualcomm is going to be pushing to manufacturers. And they also arrive now with a nice ANC, so some active noise cancellation. I'm trying not to just regurgitate the full review because I really enjoyed them, so I'm trying to like sell you on them now because I liked them, but I made a whole video about that. So that video is probably better to watch than me under-caffeinated talking about the video that I made. From Paul, hold on. Paul asks, what are the two pieces of gear you are under embargo for? Hashtag this will work. Well, Paul, I'm glad you asked. They are... Oh, you wait a minute. All right, and the other one, again, it's like I still want to put the same kind of energy into an accessory review as I do like a review of a phone or a laptop. I feel like the way that we complement our gadgets, our mainstream computing devices, is just as important as the compute power itself. And so I took a little extra time with this one. And again, it's one of those videos that's just going to die at the whims of the YouTube algorithm. But Cooler Master. Cooler Master took pity on me when I was complaining about some of the cabling on my smaller desk. And they were like, hey, well, you know, we do sell wireless keyboards and mice if you wanted to check some out. And I said, yes, I absolutely wanted to take that gear for a test drive. So I put together a combo video, the SK653 wireless gaming keyboard and the MM831 wireless gaming mouse. And I even included the mandatory ASMR switch activation sound, so you can hear my clacky blue keys and all of their audio glory, something like that. Fancy words, what are fancy? And my experience is in putting those together. I'm using them right now. I'm kind of hoping I don't need to send them back. We'll see what Cooler Master has to say about that. But I really enjoyed kind of looking at the combination of both of those products together. And again, where I liked my last keyboard and mouse, it is silly refreshing being able to just kind of move something suddenly and not having to worry about, like, oh, this cable, and I'm in the bad habit of keeping a coffee mug on my desk. And so those parts and pieces, I feel it contributes to the conversation about how we really live with these things. I do have the link for the show notes. Like I said, last week we got the Microsoft event, so I did a live stream kind of just looking at my experiences with the Duo 1 and some of the news from the Duo 2. So you can catch that as its own separate broadcast. That'll probably disappear in a week. I don't know if I'll actually save it, because I feel like when we get to the gadget block, I'll be able to put my thoughts together a bit more coherently than how I was rambling there. And then last bit for housekeeping, it's an event that we kind of been working on for a little while, writing up how we were going to put it together. You know, this is a collaborative event with a couple major companies. And I'm excited to say that I'm going to be hosting a workshop. You can register for the workshop for free. It's through videomakerevents.com. If you're not familiar with VideoMaker, they do a ton of learning events and hands-ons. And I am hosting one on mobile production. Professional mobile broadcasting with minimal crew, the right gear, with Juan Carlos Bagnell, a.k.a. Some Gadget Guy. And I'm doing this in collaboration with Sony to talk about field production, using phones as brains for nicer cameras. I'm really stoked about this one because, again, it is a partnership with Sony, but a major part of this curriculum is exactly what I was just talking about with keyboards and mice. The whole point is you have this brain, right? Here's like this phone brain. My Xperia is over there. That's kind of bad form for me to talk about this as a Sony event. But you've got this compute power. What can you do with it? And I'm getting increasingly frustrated with techies that keep hyping up more powerful processors, next gen. You've got to have the current SoC. And then literally cannot demonstrate why that matters. Except, oh, I showed you the Geekbench score. You need the bigger Geekbench score, bro. And I want to show functionality. I want to show capability. And I also want to show it in a context where if you're on, I don't know, Galaxy S9, maybe even bump it a little newer, like an LG V40, you have a ridiculous amount of mobile compute power that is perfectly capable at accomplishing really high-level mobile production. And so adding that to a workflow that gets to talk about not only Sony cameras, but all of the accessories that I've kind of played with, you know, from tripods to microphones. We're definitely going to be digging into some audio. Why maybe it's still a good idea to have headphone jacks on your pocket computers. And lighting and broadcast and software and the whole package, like how we can really put together a minimal impact field team. Maybe it's literally just one producer. You know, you walk out into the field and you have to point a camera at yourself and produce some content. That might be a part of the you know, your workflow, and I want to make sure people have the tools to accomplish that. I don't feel this conversation is fulfilled
by saying, this phone is a pro phone. It has three cameras on the back. You're like, cool, but what can I do with it? Oh, but it's more powerful. How can I use that power? And again, it's like I gotta roll my eyes every time someone's like, well, you know, for the price, what would be more worth it is if this phone had more RAM. What do you do on your phone? What are you doing on your phone that you need more RAM? Not better memory management, because I agree wholeheartedly on a bunch of phones there, but what app on your phone requires more than 8 gigabytes of RAM? Because if you're really using one, we can get into that later. I don't want to get us too bogged down. I'm excited about this. VideoMakerEvents.com. You can catch the live stream. It's going to be October 6th, starting at 9 a.m. And I'm session number one. Oh, I'm sorry, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And I'm session number one. I'm starting off this whole series of workshops. It's the me workshop, and I love it. I was so empowered to pitch this to Sony after taking that road trip. And it was a combination of V60 and OnePlus 9. I genuinely did not need a laptop or a standalone camera. And I felt like I got a pretty high level of work done. What we could accomplish with some additional gear, like a nicer camera out in the field for these types of broadcasts or mobile production, is just astounding. So, Paul, it's pro because we put a pro on the box. Duh. From Dave Burns, I don't know if I have ever hit more than 8 on my phone with 12 gigabytes of RAM, which again, the way that these things manage your memory, it's not, do you have more RAM? You want to use the RAM. RAM just sitting there doesn't help you. It's not like hard drive space, where if you max out your hard drive, oh no, your system runs so much slower. What I want is software that will take advantage of that hardware, but we're not going to get there if we've got a bunch of techie tryhards just going, no, it's not really worth it, man. You got to go after the developers, not the phone manufacturers. Those 8 gigabyte plus fellas just want to make sure their batteries are getting a workout. Too true, Simon, too true. And everyone say hey to Tech Love and Mama. We got a great crew ready to go here. it's going to be good times. Got a lot of conversation here about iPhones and such. I'll repeat, I'm not going to be buying or reviewing any Apple gear until we hear directly from Apple that their plans for sort of device scanning are shuttered. And that's gonna hurt. This would normally be sort of my harvest season of getting a bunch of clicks on and views on YouTube. So can always use all the help, all the shares. You're talking about some other products. Kind of nice to sort of spread the attention. Definitely throws a wrench into my sort of normal review schedule, but we'll have to live with that for having the principles that I'm trying to have. So. Barry, thanks, man. We totally appreciate that, and we support your decision. Well, that's very, very well appreciated. So let me get this out of the way here and get that out of the way there. So, yes, all the links, all the stories, somegadgetguy.com, show notes for this week's episode 223, if you're just kind of catching this on the audio stream or the replay crew. Let's knock out this news block. I'm going to try and hit this pretty quick. Some of this is kind of heavy. Some of this is more of the follow-up. And I feel like there's kind of a trend where we keep seeing some of these stories come out, and then we see a concerted marketing effort to kind of obfuscate the actual news. When Apple pushed pause on some of their privacy features in iOS, they doubled down on massive advertising buys and new commercials preaching privacy.
And I feel like it's getting increasingly more difficult to untangle, like, what's actually happening at these companies versus what the marketing of these companies are putting out there. When it comes to journalists and when it comes to even influencers and YouTubers, you know, we don't have the megaphones that are afforded these massive corporations when they've got billion-dollar ad campaigns. So I think it's increasingly important that these stories are kind of regularly followed up on. Let me take a quick drink of coffee here. Oh, Aditya. Algorithm. All right. So let's jump in here. Let's see if this works. I'm trying a slightly different method of sharing my screen. Ah, it did work. This one comes courtesy of Mr. Dave Burns. I shared this on our Discord. Facebook puts Instagram Kids app on hold, and there was much rejoicing. That's not a part of the Reuters headline, but it should be. Again, does Reuters... I don't think Reuters... Oh, reporting by Ava Matthews, editing by Krishna Chandru Eluri and Anil De Silva. Okay. So this is their paywalled. I have reached my limit. I clicked on this before. I'm still going to share the Reuters link because they put it in there first, but I'll just have to break this down. Apologies. I was going to actually read directly from the article, but the headline is at least insightful enough for us to kind of understand what's happening here. A number of reports have come out saying that Facebook and Instagram, these types of social media services, cause significant amounts of distress in younger people. Anxiousness, pressure to conform. You know, they find new methods of cyberbullying. It's just really not a good look for a number of these platforms that are kind of billed and marketed as ways that we can connect with our family and friends. Instead, this is starting to feel a bit more like, you know, weaponized information tactics against consumers to increase time on site. A number of Facebook stories have recently broken where, you know, we saw them entrenched with political operations to sort of unfairly manage some candidates over others. There are all those rumors pointing to Zuckerberg looking to run for president, and part of the Trump campaign was the blueprint for how a Zuckerberg campaign would be waged in a 21st century social media fashion. And so a number of Facebook replies have come out following the story saying, well, hey, you know, we're just pushing pause on this. We want to make sure we have all our ducks in a row, but we don't think we're really the cause. We're just building this platform. And it just so happens that this platform is being utilized in ways that benefits us financially, but causes extreme distress to the people who use it. But that's not on us, because all we did was build the platform. And I feel like this is the kind of doublespeak that we'll need to untangle for a number of these types of stories and situations where we start investigating antitrust, or if we're looking at monopolistic business practices, if we're looking at new FTC guidelines and regulations. We'll need to be able to untangle all of this to really make sense of how do we put checks and balances on a massive leaky data organization like Facebook. Because we don't have a good blueprint for it. We don't know, we don't have a good design on how to just put in some safety buffers for consumers. And I don't believe it's like, well, you get rid of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act and you put them under this kind of government watchdog. I do believe there needs to be sort of a market correction and a legal correction working in tandem. You know, how we monetize this traffic needs to be re-examined. How we build this content needs to be re-examined. The whole freemium model needs to be re-examined. And so I feel like both sides of this equation need to work towards what the next phase of the internet is going to resemble, or we're going to get kind of more mess like this. Short story long, like hell, I'm going to let Lex anywhere near social media until she's old enough to kind of fully understand like the gamification and the social engineering and the obvious manipulation of data. So So it's going to be a while. Like, I'm trying to think. I don't know that I've broken 10 photos of Lex on social media, so we'll have to see how we bring her in to participating online. Because right now we're really slow playing those kinds of services. From Aditya Anil, oh, the chat scrolled on me too fast. Aditya Anil was saying, hopefully it's put on hold indefinitely. I can't put up that comment. Simon says, no, I'm already unmonetizable for so many of my stories here. Oh, here's the details. I finally caught back up with it. Hopefully the app is put on hold indefinitely. Last thing we need are kids pining for likes and working to satisfy yet another algorithm. I mean, that's already happened. Increasingly younger and younger people are saying, like, hey, when I grow up, I want to be an influencer. Because that's kind of the media that they're consuming. In the same way that someone my age, when we were five, like, we would have idolized a TV star. You know, that was the media that we're consuming. So it's not so much that I have any sort of ill will towards that dynamic. That's generational. Back a long time ago, it would have been, I want to be a rock and roller. We have this penchant towards, like, fame and entertainment, and there's a desire to create something, and especially from people who don't understand the work that's involved. They see the fruits of that labor and they think, yeah, that's what I want, but they don't fully understand all of the mechanics that go into creating that. What I feel is what we've seen with every evolution of the distribution model has been sort of another way to manipulate behavior. And that's the thing I'm really anxious about is, If Lex watches TV and she sees actors at their craft, I still feel there's something respectable towards the entire collaborative effort that goes into writing something and producing something and the performers and the learning and the skill and everything coming together. And it's incredible to me that any TV show or movie is ever finished when you see how much effort goes into that. I don't have the same feelings towards an outlet like Facebook. I feel that's much more manipulative and disingenuous in what its claimed mission is trying to accomplish. We all know that TV exists to sell subscriptions or to sell advertising. We get all that. We get the art and commerce. I don't feel Facebook and Instagram live up to their stated mission of bringing people together as much as they kind of tear us apart. That was a really rambling and soapboxy way to say you should check out the Reuters article, which will be linked in the show notes. So all Greg's saying it's a good idea to keep Lex off social media. I just want her to have control. Again, I'm enough of an angsty liberal Hollywood dude, I'm not going to utilize her likeness for my own personal financial gain. You know, like, I feel there should be a contract there. I feel an agent should be looking out for her best interests. Maybe she should have a manager telling me no. Because I feel like a lot of my content would be a lot more successful with a really adorable, precocious 5-year-old running around and articulating things about gadgets and how daddy has too many phones. Tech Love and Mama, I get the concerns, but I've approached social media differently when I let them have it. But I think tech savvier than most parents. Oh, but I'm tech savvy. Most parents are not. I just missed, there needed to be a comma there, Tech Love and Mama. I'm just correcting your grammar. Most parents are not, so I see and get the concerns. It's not so much like, you know, Marie and I show restraint, but also we want to be able to have those conversations with Lex about, hey, when you see this information, it's coming from a source. And when you can examine what the source is, you can kind of untangle the entire through line and you can make better choices with your time and with your entertainment when you're able to put all of these pieces together. And I feel that's a bit much for a 6-year-old, an almost 6-year-old. I don't think she's too far off from starting to have some of those conversations, though. And I think she'll start understanding like, media is created and media is distributed, and there are probably perspectives built into those mechanisms that unfairly weight some content over others. Get this out of the way. Tech Levin, I'm multitasking, sorry. It's okay. I am too. Again, I don't know if you've noticed this stream, like my ability to host, pretty darn good. All right. I said we were going to chew through news. So we've got a pair of EU stories that are ongoing. Obviously, I think if you follow streams like mine, you've probably been hip to the news. EU proposes legislation requiring USB-C charging ports on devices, including iPhones and digital cameras. Now, I really like the write-up from dpreview.com. This was written up by Jeremy Gray. So I'm linking to this one in the show notes because I think it's a better illustration of this idea than just, they're coming for Apple, because they're coming for everybody. Do you know what industry really needs the swiftest kick up the arse? I mean, yes, Apple. I think we can always start with the biggest tech corporation that's using the dumbest connector for their phones. Sure. But outside of that industry, we have an entire global infrastructure of audio and video equipment that still often falls back on micro USB. There are new, expensive, premium, nice microphones being sold today that still use micro USB. There are fancy new cameras that are using that weird split USB 3 micro that never became a standard. Like, in terms of consumer electronics, it's used on hard drives and the Galaxy S5. And it's being used still on a number of newer cameras, camera bodies, and video equipment. This is a far-reaching issue. And I don't know why those industries... I mean, I kind of understand why. When it comes to camera equipment, when it comes to recording equipment, those are long-lived industries. They find standards, they stick with those standards, and they're reluctant to change to a new standard because of the march of technology. So, you know, a classic microphone is using a connector that might be 100 years old, but it's the right connector for that job. We don't have the same surety with digital equipment, especially consumer electronics. But I feel like the writing's on the wall. Like, out of all of the connectors that we've played with from the inception of USB-A and the printer connector on USB cables to USB-C, where we had, you know, mini USB, micro USB, micro USB 3, USB-C feels like it's the connector. So I feel like we're even maybe a little past, you know, this being the right time to make this play. I think we're actually a little overdue just saying, stop with the different connectors. We can agree on this one. And especially with USB 4 and Thunderbolt 4 kind of merging some of those feature sets and throughput and the connectivity and the ability to use it for monitors and displays. I feel we've gotten there. I feel like this is the right time to say, move on and make your products a little bit more sustainable, add a little bit more longevity. Again, it kills me when you got this amazing microphone, but you're like, hey, you got to use a cable that's increasingly becoming an antique. You know, a micro USB cable in 2021 is harder to find, is harder to buy. We're trying to get rid of it. And if you need to replace that cable, it's not as likely. You'll just be able to go down to a corner store, or like a 7-Eleven or something, and just pick one up if you need something because you're traveling. And this definitely speaks to some of the confusion with USB-C, but we won't solve that problem, I feel, until we can kind of give up on some of these other connectors. So I am wholeheartedly in support of this, and not just because of the iPhone situation. The timetable that this commission is talking about, I think it's entirely likely that iPhone 14 could be this total redesign that they're claiming it's going to be, and that in the 2 years that they're giving companies to kind of adopt new manufacturing strategies, Apple could just remove all the ports from the iPhone and make it even more sort of sealed up, walled garden-y, harder to repair, is kind of the, you know, thumbing their nose. You don't say thumbing your eye, that's not a saying. Thumbing their nose at this commission to say, well, okay, well, fine, we'll just get rid of all the ports and you have to go and buy really expensive wireless charging gear, because that will probably be the only exclusion and the only way that Apple can keep proprietary lock-in on accessories and cables. So Gabaletta, this is totally true. Gabaletta writes, problem is not every USB-C is the same. Some are still using legacy USB 2, but with the C connector, there should be a standardized standard that at least starts at USB 3. So I appreciate that. The reason why I'm not as angsty about it, I feel the main thing we need to accomplish is certifying a cable standard. I ran into this on my road trip where I had a lap dock and I had some USB-C to USB-C cables, but those aren't the same as the more thunderbolty cables that my lap docks really like. So I forgot to pack my lap dock cable. I would plug my phone into this lap dock and I couldn't have video and mass storage and keyboard and trackpad support all at the same time. It wouldn't put a video out on this really nice USB-C to USB-C cable. So I feel the only thing we really need to certify is saying, this is a USB-C cable. It will work for everything that has a USB-C connection. So basically, I feel like every cable just needs to be a Thunderbolt cable. And from there, we'll be able to address all of the sort of myriad issues that happen with charging, with video out, with accessory connections. And I understand why some manufacturers go cheaper. There's probably less of an expectation on a mid-ranger phone that you're going to hook it up to a whole bunch of things. I would hope that it just becomes prohibitively expensive to keep manufacturing older USB standards. But I feel the major consumer confusion happens when, hey, you've got this phone and you want to use something like DeX and you plug it in and like nothing comes out. Well, I plugged in the USB cable. Why can't I see my phone screen? Or why can't I see DeX pop up on this monitor? And that to me is the first problem, the major hurdle to solve. I feel like at this point, there shouldn't be different cables. I know that probably would make some cables more expensive in the short term, but then once all manufacturing is kind of set to a Thunderbolt 4 standard, then it should actually get cheaper, right? Because you're not making all kinds of different cables, you're just making one kind of cable. Anyway. All from Greg. Sorry, just a quick tangent. Do you think if Apple goes portless with wireless, will wireless debugging be good enough? No. I think going portless is a terrible idea. I can't imagine, you know, think of the iPhone Pro and think of that real tasty ProRes video that you're going to shoot and how you can't even shoot 4K at the highest qualities on an iPhone with the lowest storage model. And then I want you to think about wireless transferring of data that big, 4K video. That is ludicrously stupid. But I have to assume that's what Apple is going to be building towards. So anything that depends on that kind of connection, like if you're really trying to do work, you know, like in Android land, we can do ADB, we can do debugging that way, we can do all kinds of really interesting things with our phones. No, you don't want to go wireless. That's a terrible idea. But Apple's going to do it. All right. One other EU news article here. And again, just it's the to keep up with what's going on.
This is an AP news feed by Kelvin Chan. Google is in court to appeal the EU's 2018 Android antitrust case. We covered this on the podcast. It's one of three antitrust penalties totaling more than $8 billion that the commission hit Google with between 2017 and 2019. So this is the one that claims Google has been stifling competition because of the way that they mandate manufacturers cannot have competing forks of Android, and that certain Android apps are a part of a bundled collection that have to be installed on the phone. And the reason why this sounds familiar is because it's a similar, it's not exactly the same, there's a lot of differences in the nuances, but it feels a little similar to how the EU went after Microsoft for including a web browser back in like the Windows XP days. Google is kind of doing the same thing here, and it's insufficient to say that, well, other manufacturers or other companies like Apple have a much higher degree of lock-in or way more anti-competitive. I feel we need to lower the bar on anti-competitive business practices. And if a company wants to try and make a fork of a product and they think they can, I don't think they should face punitive actions from Google as to how they get sort of preferred Google certifications for certain Android devices. Again, you look at like the market that Amazon created with their Fire branded stuff. I feel like that is actually good for the competitive market if there is a different flavor of that arriving beyond just, well, we kind of customized a skin a little bit, but Google made us put on these apps and services. I think there's a competitive argument to be made for kind of spreading the wealth just a little bit here. So this is going to be going through appeals. It's a big enough fine. I mean, with $8 billion, that one actually stings a tiny little bit. So I think Google is probably going to play hardball on this one. But again, I'm not impressed by arguments that, like, because Apple is worse at this kind of stuff, that means Google should be able to engage in the business practices that they want to. You know what I mean? It's just the kind of the flavor of the argument. I want to see stricter consumer protections at a lower level for everybody. And then we kind of have a better shot at a competitive marketplace. See, this is what the commission originally said from the article. The commission ruled that Google broke EU rules by requiring smartphone makers to make a bundle of Google apps if they wanted any at all, and prevented them from selling devices with altered versions of Android. So in the Android ecosystem, we make a big play out of this. We talk about AOSP and how Android is open source. Apologies for my creaky chair. But is it really open source if there's kind of a Google certified flavor of that? And I have it's a difficult philosophical argument. If a consumer, again, there's like a free market idea to this. If a consumer wants what Google says Android should be, we see the excitement brewing for Pixel 6. There is a Pixel 5a. There are the Google hardware teams that are making that product real. Outside of that, I feel other manufacturers should be free to experiment with open source initiatives and not have to worry about Google kind of pulling the rug out from under them if they don't include the correct bundle of Google services on those types of products. I'm still kind of flirting. Like, I want to try and play again. I did this at Pocket Now for one of the Pocket Now weeklies years ago, just talking about like, hey, these are some of the other apps and services that I use. When I'm traveling, I don't use Google Maps. I use Here Maps. If I want to check my email, there are alternative email clients to using Gmail. And like putting together a list of what those services would look like to make an Android less Googled kind of device. And I feel like if a manufacturer wanted to step into that space and craft something built around those ideas, it could be a really compelling argument to that. And then we would have more of a consumer choice. We would have the Pixel for the most Googled version of that idea, and then we could have like a spectrum of how Googled a product might be. Russ is asking, where did Russ's comment go?
Hey folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on r glowing rectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
Oh, hold on. I want to read this one. This is Slick Rick Moranis. That's a pretty good name. I like that. If Apple thinks that filmmakers will want to use the cinematic mode on their brand new camera without being able to painlessly get the video off the phone in the first place, they've got another thing coming. I have noticed that Apple aficionados will highlight a very specific workflow that plays into exactly what Apple marketing has determined is the right way to use that product. I personally feel professional should mean the ability to flex and adapt to different working conditions. And one of the things that I kind of highlight there, when I shoot on an iPhone, it is really difficult to get that footage off of the iPhone unless you are 100% from soup to nuts in an Apple workflow. So when a YouTuber highlights, like, yeah, I got this iPhone and I'm throwing this footage into Final Cut and this is what it's doing and isn't that so great? If there's one piece of your chain that is not Apple, then it kind of falls apart. So for a number of my phones, if I go wireless, I'm not like sharing AirDrop style to a computer. I'm uploading over Wi-Fi to my NAS. Well, if I do that on an iPhone, there is a special preparing algorithm that squishes the video quality before it leaves the iPhone. It degrades the video quality. I can't show you directly if I upload to my NAS. I have to find some combination of local storage. I get a memory card. I get an SD card adapter. It takes forever to transfer over USB 2. It is very painful to make that happen and show you the exact video quality. So again, I wholeheartedly believe that Apple is working towards this, and a bunch of iPhone fans are going to say it's so convenient, and they're going to miss the larger point over what it takes to transfer gigabytes and gigabytes of video over a wireless connection like that. Oops. Let me get that out of the way right here. All right. So, where are we? 9:45. Okay. You know what? I gotta focus. We're gonna chew through. I'm gonna focus. News. We're gonna get news. I do have a couple Apple stories here. This is another follow-up to a story we talked about a couple months back. Yet another researcher drops 3 iOS 0 days that Apple has refused to fix. This is coming by way of Bleeping Computer. Please read through this whole article, because some of this stuff is actually a little bit scary in what, you know, certain pieces of code can do on iOS 15 to extract information off of your phones. And yet again, this is the second story in less than a year, there's a bug and security bounty that Apple puts out. So Apple says, hey, instead of selling exploits to some gray market or black hat kind of hacker, if you find something on one of our products, come to us, we'll give you monies, just to make sure that we can fix these problems before they really affect consumers. And yet another researcher, we covered another story where Apple, on I think it was a pair of security exploits, not a trio, but a pair of security exploits that the person saying like, hey, I feel like this is worth the amount of money that you said it was, and Apple kind of disregarded it, so then he published it. You're like, well, Apple will eventually fix it, and that's kind of the case, and we're seeing this again. Apple kind of not living up to their promises that if you go to them, that they'll pay for this information and to make their products more secure. The breakdown on this article from Bleeping Computer better assembles all of this. But again, it cuts to what we're going to talk about with Apple also. A company that pours so much money into the marketing of security and the marketing of privacy, but kind of not really living up to their own claims. And our ability to disseminate that information, again, when I bring things up like this, it's just as likely I'll have people going like, yeah, screw Apple, they suck, as I will having people go like, you're just a hater. Apple's the best at doing all of this privacy stuff, and Google sells all your data. And you're like, neither of those is accurate. There are so many people using Apple products. We actually need to care about this stuff. The proliferation of malware, the vulnerabilities, the family and friends that you know who are going to be affected by this stuff, the apps that can make it past Apple's security checks. Like, this matters for all of us. And it makes the computing landscape much more dangerous. And if the computing landscape is more dangerous, we're going to have fewer people earnestly participating. Which also cuts to the next story that we've got. And I've got a pair of links for this one, too. So, Apple, privacy, billboards, big campaigns. According to the Washington Post, a team of security researchers and a former Apple employee, the privacy settings that Apple has are so narrowly defined that they might just be placebos. So when you tell an app not to track you, apparently that does nothing. Apparently, that app can still decide to share anything it wants. This was originally written up by Jeffrey Fowler and Tatum Hunter from the Washington Post. On your iPhone, you can now tap a button that says, ask app not to track. But behind the scenes, some apps keep snooping anyway. So Apple has so narrowly defined tracking for a very specific flavor of advertising that the ability for an app to fingerprint almost everything that happens on your phone is still completely wide open. Lockdown found most of the... let me highlight this better. Lockdown found most of the apps continued to communicate behind the scenes with a murky industry of third-party data companies that privacy advocates call trackers. You've probably never heard of most of them, but they can receive a flood of information from your phone, potentially revealing how you use apps and even your location. Their uses for the data could be benign, like helping an app find bugs and track how well its design works, or they could be feeding your information to advertisers and data brokers. And Apple's privacy features here don't seem to stop any of this. So the narrow band. So here's data shared with ChartBoost by Subway Surfers, Streamer Life, and RunRich 3D. Device name, so what you've named the phone. Accessibility settings for text. Accessibility for text size. Display settings. The app can report back if you're using dark mode, what the screen resolution is, what your time zone is. Total storage space, free storage space, currency, so the currency you use to buy apps and services, what version of iOS you're using, audio output, audio input, accessibility settings, audio output including Bluetooth connections, the country you're in, your cell carrier, the last time you restarted your phone with timestamps and location precision, your enabled keyboard, your calendar, your current battery level, current screen brightness, if you're in landscape or portrait mode, whether or not your phone is charging, what exact phone model you're using, what language, what browser you're surfing with, and your IP address. So here you go. You install a fun little wacky running game on your iPhone. And Subway Surfers is one I've heard of. So it's not like some obscure Chinese malware that somehow snuck past Apple's security checks. You say, don't track me. And it's still reporting all of this data on you. It's still absorbing all of that. But we feel way more comfortable about having the placebo button, right? We feel way better about those giant black iPhone billboards. Privacy iPhone. That's hugely invasive. So we've got a team of security researchers communicating with the Washington Post, And we also had another, this one was hilarious, like on the Apple subreddits. It's like, former employee is disgruntled. Like, we can really trust that. But this isn't unique information. So a former Apple employee, a former Apple engineer says, the button on iPhones asking apps not to track you is a dud. Gives users a false sense of privacy. This one was written up by Hannah Towey, who at Business Insider. And so I actually pulled this from Yahoo News, but critics of the ads have called them misleading. Much of what users do on their iPhones and the data they generate doesn't stay on their devices. iPhones routinely send some data to wireless carriers, websites, app developers, and to Apple's own servers and services. This is kind of a big deal. We have an expectation based on the marketing that does not live up to that marketing. And this is the problem I've had with Apple and their claims, I would say, since the iPhone 10. You know, when I was test driving an iPhone 8 at Pocket Now, and Apple talked about that as kind of like a refresh, it's the iPhone 7 wireless charging, like I felt like, okay, yeah, this phone makes sense for what they're trying to say. Beyond that point, look at what they're claiming with, like, cinematic mode, pro camera features, privacy. We can tell apps not to track your information because Apple is so secure. They keep raising the bar on this messaging and pouring so much money into proliferating this message. I think they've forgotten to actually accomplish the claim that they're not really living up to that standard. And this is incredibly important. So again, a very specific flavor of advertiser style tracking probably is disabled. Every other piece of your information that can fingerprint, identify you, and be a monetizable source of data for an advertising or some kind of click farm is still being sent off of your iPhone. The only way that you can safeguard not having some of this data brokered is to not use apps. Like, we need to do a better job of actually locking this stuff down. And the permissions that get pulled from Android and from iOS help us accomplish that. So now we need an entirely new consumer education to empower people so that they understand. When you say, hey, don't do this, it's still going to do all of this. Hey, you told it not to get your location. That's great. It's not going to track your location now. It's still going to get, like, IP addresses, which can identify your location. It's so absurdly literal to a legal definition that it doesn't actually pass the muster of real-world use. And that's insane. That's just so galling. So Aditya Anil, we probably might see some kind of class action built on this, built on this kind of information. I've got to get back to his comment here. What's preventing a lawsuit against them now? Is it some sort of phrasing that says they won't track their data on their servers and on app servers, but no guarantee of data being sent to third-party servers? That is exactly what I'm talking about. It is so literally specific to one very minute kind of claim, they're probably legally protected. It's the same thing. The iPhone is going to be 60% more powerful than the competition, but they don't tell you under what conditions. They don't tell you what the competing device was. They don't tell you 60% more powerful in a benchmark, in a real world app, in some type of obscure measurement of AI background processing. They don't give you the specifics, so you can't pin them down on that claim or verify how that claim might be true. And again, they get even cagier and cagier with those kinds of claims, crouching them in more fields and less data. The more data you have, the less those claims seem to be true. So that pair of articles is kind of intense. I really wanted to believe that iOS had, like, when you push, hey, don't track or don't pull data, and especially with the Facebook response, how Facebook came out swinging against Apple for this type of business practice. I really wanted to believe that, like, you said don't track, and Apple built a firewall. And it makes me crazy that that's the way they kind of present it to consumers, and it doesn't seem to be true at all. So, another conversation I have with our family and friends, the only defense we have is better informed behavior. That's it. That's all we have. That's what we've got. How you interact with these services, where you interact with these services, how you're signing on to networks, what kind of data you're giving up, and it really is buyer beware. Apple is not an altruistic company just doing the bestest for their customers. They are the world's most profitable tech company. They make billions of dollars a year making sure you can't change away from Google search. So they don't profit off of your search behavior, but they totally profit off of your search behavior. The nuances of that need to be communicated to our family and friends. I've got two quick FCC stories, and then we can plug the subreddit. I did not win the subreddit this week. I'm really excited about that. But Dave Burns, but their marketing makes me feel good. It does. Again, it made me feel good. It burns me just a little bit more because I want to have that solution for my less tech-savvy aunts and uncles. I want to be able to point, like my grandmother, to easy-to-use consumer electronics that will help protect some of the behaviors she might engage with. It's absolutely not an iPhone, apparently. I adore Jessica Rosenworcel at the FCC. I am, let's say, moderately disappointed in President Biden not making her the permanent chairwoman of the FCC. But apparently a group of senators are pushing Joe Biden to just instate her as the head of the FCC. She has done phenomenal work during a global pandemic to raise the profile of this underfunded commission to try and actually help people on the ground. And one of the initiatives that she spearheaded is actually starting to pay out right now. FCC showers schools across the U.S. with $1.2 billion from the Emergency Connectivity Fund. This is written up by Devin Coldiwe. I have no idea how to pronounce that name, Devin. I'm sorry. Over on TechCrunch, the FCC has sent out the first checks from its Emergency Connectivity Fund in effort to help close the homework gap at schools by covering the costs of computers and internet services. Thousands of school districts in every state, plus DC, Guam, and Puerto Rico, will split this first $1.2 billion distribution, and there's still lots more to come. She has put together a $7 billion fund. I mean, obviously through the political wranglings of parties and funds and budgets, it's a complicated process. $7 billion is going to be going out, and most of it aimed at subsidizing the ground floor, the grassroots, the people actually using these products, trying to get somewhat modern and inexpensive pieces of computing equipment into the hands of teachers and students. And so if you have family members, maybe they live in more rural areas, maybe they're in underfunded school districts, maybe they lack access to 21st century communications equipment, point them in this direction. The monies are going out. In this first wave of funding, a massive portion of this is going to go to the states in the country that are already some of the most affluent. The three top recipients of these initial grants are going to California, New York State, and Texas. So it's not a red or blue thing. It's not a liberal or conservative thing. It's tons of school districts are using outdated equipment and lack connection services, both in their schools and for their students at home. Some of the most rural, spread out, and underfunded states are going to get like a couple hundred thousand dollars That's not because of the FCC being selective. It's because those school districts in those states are not filling out the applications to get this funding approved. Teachers, parents, school administrators, we need to put way more pressure on them. This money is going to go out. And I'm not saying it shouldn't go to California, New York, and Texas. We have humongous populations of people, and our states are crazy more diverse than what, like, the electoral votes on a presidential election might resemble. You know, there are blue and red areas of every one of these states. There are highly urban underfunded centers, and there are highly rural underfunded education centers. Go. Tell people. Between this and the Emergency Broadband Act, you know, if you know someone who's struggling, there is money available to help subsidize their connection. If you know a school district that is not getting the job done, there is money available. And we've got to spread the word on that kind of stuff. So again, my tier of disappointment is reaching moderate, that Joe Biden, President Joe Biden, has not instated Jessica Rosenworcel as head of the FCC. When we see the effectiveness of this type of policy is huge. And it's not just good for business. It actually manages to kind of help both. Local internet providers are going to get a windfall of money coming in from the consumers who were helping to subsidize and bring them up to date with this kind of tech. That's a win-win. I can't see what part of the political aisle you would have to sit on to not recognize the benefit of this money from tax dollars actually going towards serving needs from people on the ground, which then also has an immediate business corollary, which helps the economy. Like, all of this works. So I've been very impressed. I very much enjoy the work that she's been doing as chairwoman of the FCC, and she needs to be made permanent because this stuff is so much more effective and so much better than the last head of the FCC that we were working with. From Dave Burns, I went to a high school that would never had the ability to give every kid a laptop in 2008 if our admin and IT admins applied for a grant to get every kid a MacBook. And look at me now, a productive member of society. I don't know if trolling on podcasts is productive, but you're very good at it. That's very effective, David. And thank you for sharing a number of links and stuff, because you definitely helped pad out my news block this week. From Tiger Kim, as someone in the Deep South, we are definitely lacking when it comes to technology and funding in general. This is what I want my tax dollars to go towards. California subsidizes a bunch of red states. We put so much more money into federal coffers than we receive from the federal government. So get after your school board, get after your school administrators, get after your local politicians. Because this could be way better. It's there. I'm throwing my tax returns at you right now. So go get it. This is what I mean. We need to be active members of this conversation. You know, write a letter to your senator. Write a letter to your local state officials. Tell them, go do it. It's the monies. Oh, man, it drives me nuts. Got a lot of people, and especially people like me, we complain about this kind of stuff online, but every single time we can demonstrate this. Instead of writing a tweet or a Facebook post, write directly to an elected member of your local government. Do it. All right. Dave Burns. Ouch. Oh, and Tech Love and Mama, I'm still waiting for my tax return since February. Ouch. I got mine filed like crazy early. Like Marie was really on top of putting together all of our taxes for last year. So I think ours came in relatively quick. But I can't. And Gabaletta, my mother has been in the Department of Education in Puerto Rico for over 25 years. The painstaking steps that she needs to go through to try and get schools any type of federal or local help is a nightmare. I can totally appreciate that too. I don't know. There's this weird blind spot that we have in our federal government for a protectorate like Puerto Rico, and it often gets the short end of the stick in a lot of the conversations that we have when we've got an entire country full of American citizens that often get neglected for the services and the support that they need. Here, let me get this out of the way. So I went a little longer on the news block, but good news is we've got two exciting things to share on the subreddit. Every podcast has a subreddit. My podcast is no different, but my subreddit is focused on trying to help support content creators, and I want to build it up as a platform to share content we think deserves more attention. You can totally share content from really large outlets and really large YouTube channels, really large publications, but the core mission is to find the content that we think needs more of a voice, or to advocate for the content that we don't feel is getting more attention. Share every article or share every video from a major YouTuber, that's not our mission. But let's say a really big YouTube channel puts out a video that's very informative, really well put together, and it underperforms. That would be a great fit for reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Exciting announcement for the subreddit number one. I did not win the subreddit this week. This is not the me subreddit, but I had a really solid winning streak. I think I'm going to hit harder this week. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. Number one, David Amell, starting his own channel, 6,400 subscribers, 6,400 subscribers on Google's Pixel 6, Tensor, and the Age of Ambient Computing. The number two spot, we've got Grant Likes Tech. He's got 20,000 subscribers, and he's just sharing some thoughts on the Xperia 1 Mark III for battery life, overheating using the camera, and general connectivity. And then number three, we've got Mitchell Millennial with 23,000, almost 24,000 subscribers. Your phone is a supercomputer, so start using it like one with Samsung DeX. All three of these missions of my own heart. Absolutely love it. Pixel 6 commentary looking at a competitive SoC in this space. You know, Google making their own custom chips. A Sony video, an Xperia 1 Mark III video. This was the week of everybody getting their iPhones. And what we felt deserved more attention was so broad on this subreddit. If you go to YouTube, you're going to just see iPhone video, iPhone video, iPhone video, iPad mini is rocking my socks. There is so much more tech to talk about. And look, now that the major channels no longer have exclusivity on the embargo videos for the Fold and the Flip or the iPhone 13 and the new iPad mini, those major outlets are now talking about iPhone 14 rumors and Galaxy S22 leaks. Consumers have just gotten the new Samsungs, the folding and flipping phones. Consumers have literally just started receiving the new iPhone, and we're already off because the novelty is gone now that the normies can talk about these products too. That's horrifically toxic. I don't care what defense you have of larger channels. Well, you can't expect someone with 10 million subscribers to do follow-up videos. They can't afford to do that with the insane amount of money they make on ad revenues and sponsorships and products and stuff. No, we can't expect them to do their jobs. Now is the time to expand on these conversations, and I'm so proud of my little subreddit for picking news and highlighting and upvoting a broad collection of tech and news stories here. So number four, we've got a great video from Hugh Jeffries, kind of a sort of a, what do I want to say? It's sort of a buyer beware story about replacing your battery and how a lot of older batteries can sometimes get relabeled or rewrapped to say that they're newer. One of my videos from reviews.org, why are broadband upload speeds so much slower than download speeds? This was a really fun video to put together and just kind of, again, another consumer advocacy piece. Rounding out the top 10, we've got Adam Reviews Tech. Buy iPhone 13 now if you have these iPhones. We've got Grant doing a camera comparison between the OnePlus 9 Pro and the Pixel 5a. We've got Cedric Wilson, under 1,000 subscribers. He is at 910 subscribers checking out the Galaxy Z Fold 3. This is someone who I'm pretty sure spent his own money to share his opinion on the Galaxy Z Fold 3. As an artist and someone who would actually make use of the S Pen on a Samsung and not just doing that weird thing that tech reviewers do where they just kind of doodle like some waggly lines to show you how the digitizer works. How about an informed video from someone with under 1,000 subscribers who is a legit artist? His thumbnail has this really great cartoon Bucky Barnes from The Winter Soldier. Maybe that video is more worth it for your support than what a mainstream tech reviewer would do during the embargo week on a product they really haven't used that much. I'm just saying. Putting his actual money towards it or playing the embargo game to hype up the YouTube algorithm for your own financial benefit. What do you want to support? I guess technically you could do both. So reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. There's one other exciting announcement for this subreddit. I am really bad at highlighting or celebrating milestones. Someone had to tell me that I broke 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. I genuinely do not try to obsess over those kinds of details. Excuse me. And the more I pay attention to them, the more like mind energy I dedicate. So as soon as I log into YouTube, it's everything I can do to just like escape all of the red arrows that YouTube tells me I'm doing a bad job, and it's basically just hell on your mental health.
Just a quick interjection here, folks. I love highlighting good work and talented people, producers and writers who deserve more attention. So here's a quick word from someone making cool stuff on the internet, and I hope you check out what they have to offer.
Hey everyone, this is Zach of Zach Talks Tech. If you're looking to make sense of the tech that you love, if you're looking for an unfiltered opinion, someone who's just straight to the gun, gets right to it, no nonsense, come on over to Zach Talks Tech. I stream 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 9:15 p.m. Eastern, and then I cut up clips of that show and I throw them out there for you on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But if you want to be part of the live show, check it out Monday, Wednesday, Fridays at 9:15 p.m. Eastern. Check it out, Zach Talks Tech on YouTube. That's ZakTalksTech. Or as they call it up here in Canada, it could also be Zed. ZakTalksTech. Check him out on all the socials. We'll see you there.
YouTube is really bad for your mental health. Thanks for watching, everybody. I stream on Twitch. We crested a really fun milestone, and now I genuinely need your help because I'm not sure exactly how to celebrate it. But if you go to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and you scroll over to the sidebar and you look at the members, well, you'll see 2,000 members, but that often means like they're rounding up. So if you have like 1,800, they just kind of round it up to the nearest 1,000. But not anymore. We officially have 2,005 members subscribed to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We have real 2,000 subscribers. This was kind of a big deal. The last 2 weeks have seen some of the largest jumps. Like when I first started this, like I'd get 1 to 3 new subscribers every week. Every time I would bring it up, like, oh, yeah, I'll click subscribe, sure. We're starting to find that rollover where from week to week, it's not spiking. It's never like a, you know, some logarithmic jump or some huge increase. But from week to week, it's organically growing a few more subscribers here, a few more subscribers there. And over the last 2 weeks, we've seen two of the largest jumps in the subscriber count, in the member count for the subreddit. So the joke is pizza party. And I'm fine if everyone wants to buy their own pizzas, eat pizza at the same time. I cannot send you pizzas. There's just no way. Okay, what's hilarious is that I did spend maybe 20 minutes one day trying to figure out, like, if I set up this type of, like, Google Doc and people put in their data and their info, maybe I could try and work out some way of international shipping, paying, and sourcing pizza. Can't happen. It's not going to happen. I just, like, there is no way logistically for me to buy, you know, first of all, there's no way for me to afford 2,000 pizzas. But also, there's no way for me to, like, logistically get that done. So I want to do some kind of fun live stream. I mean, even if it's just something silly, like, I'll stream it unlisted on my YouTube channel. And then it's just to live on this subreddit. But, you know, if it's a specific topic, if it's just my experiences building this over time, if it's we want to try and have guests, I'd really like some ideas. It doesn't necessarily have to be just right now in this live chat, especially for the replay crew. If you're watching this or if you're listening to this after the live broadcast, hit me up on Twitter, shoot me a message from my website. SomeGadgetGuy.com has a contact page. I missed 1,000 subscribers. We didn't do anything to celebrate the first 1,000. I really want to do something to celebrate this milestone. And I want it to be kind of open and inclusive, but specifically for this subreddit, not just like a YouTube video that's going to live on in my feed. And actually, with the videos that I've got coming out this week, that wouldn't be good for me anyway. So 2005 members. We finally broke through. We're growing. We're scrapping. We're clawing every single week. Everything we can do to help spread the word, sharing it. Upvotes are critical. I definitely want to see more up arrows clicked on the posts that are shared. Comments. There have been the occasional fantastic conversations breaking down in some of the comments on this. It really is the labor of love, but I feel it's so rewarding when I find new content creators that I never would have heard of through YouTube. And that, I feel, is a critical mission missing from a lot of our social media. reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. We're getting bigger every day, and it's because of your support, and I can't thank you enough. So, so Aditya Anil saying, dude, we're happy to celebrate with you. A pizza party sounds dope. I think we're going to have to call it the pizza party stream, but I don't want to set up the expectation that if you join the stream, I will send you pizza. And I don't want it to be something, so like Sammy's saying, too many regional pizza styles. If I get a Domino's, I may not eat it. If I do a pizza on my side, I think I'm going to try and recreate that Sicilian style that Lex and I made, because wow, did that come out good. Giant sheet cookie pan of just way too much crust and dough and sauce and cheese. And she actually picked out mushroom pepperoni. So I was really proud of her. We put together just a banger of a pizza. It was so good. Dave Burns, I will get my own pizza. All right, we're gonna call it the pizza party stream. I like that. You know, like every 1,000 new subscribers, we'll have a pizza party stream. But again, with the forewarning that I will not be supplying the pizza. All right, moving right along, we're getting into the gadget block here. I only have one story for the gadget block. I will not be reviewing the iPhone 13. I will not be reviewing any Apple products until we see them change their policy on privacy. But I need to highlight good work when we see an outlet actually fulfilling their stated mission. I've seen way too many outlets trying to boil down this article. It really bothers me when a company or sort of like an editorialist or a reviewer puts together just a really in-depth, like step-by-step, this is what we're seeing. And then an outlet like The Verge tries to like cliff notes it. And I caught a part of this because I saw a headline come in on my Google News feed that The Verge was talking about iFixit iPhone teardown. But when you go to The Verge article, the link for the actual teardown is not at the top of the article. And that kind of stuff drives me crazy. So instead of linking to one of the other tech reviewing outlets or editorial sites that is watering down, I'll be linking directly to the iFixit iPhone 13 Pro teardown. And I adore the way that iFixit discusses a product teardown. They've got x-rays. They've got an entire sort of a step-by-step approach to how you would take the phone apart. And they're sharing some terrific insights on what's actually inside, from the camera modules to the new batteries to the new taptic motor. If you want to know what actually is in an iPhone, you can't trust Apple. If you go to the Apple specs page, they won't tell you what's really in their product. And they'll often blur the lines between different phones. The iPhone 12 Pro and 12 Pro Max both have 12 megapixel cameras. Except the 12 Pro Max has a larger camera sensor than the iPhone 12 Pro. No, they're both 12 megapixels. They're basically the same, except for all of the ways that a larger sensor influences photography, low light performance, and depth of field. But other than that, we're Apple. We don't need to actually disclose these things. What benefit to consumers would there be if we told you what was in our products? Which is why we have iFixit. And iFixit.com, teardown, iPhone plus 13 plus Pro plus teardown. Just go check it out. Their photography is awesome. It's like white box, pure, clean, simple. You can see everything that they're working on. You'll get the full scoop on what tools you would need to disassemble an iPhone, and you'll literally see everything that goes in there. The size of the battery, the watt hours of the battery, the camera modules. It is gorgeous work. Chef's kiss. So go support them. If you see another outlet posting a recap on their teardown, don't give them the click. Go to iFixit.com and you'll get better information. Tell them Juan sent you. They don't know who I am. excuse me. Actually, I got to drink more water. I'm way too dry and I overdid it on the coffee. some Gabaletta. I wonder what kind of camera gear they use to take those shots. It's not really the camera gear that I think what it makes their teardown so impressive. I think it's what they do is they set up like a proper what do you call that? So when you take the photo, there's a way to stage a product photo where it's like a mini white psych and white diffusers in a box. And then the flash hits and diffuses the light from all angles so that you don't get any hard directional shadows. Like you can see soft shadows coming from sort of side angles on the phone, but they're very, very minimal. They're very soft. So when you're actually seeing the internal components, they're not only properly illuminated, you can kind of pull more visual information out of that setup. What is that called? Lightbox. Derp. Big derp. Thank you, Dave Burns. Oh man, because again, I'm real good at what I do. So the camera matters a lot less. The lighting is what's critical, and especially for all of these tiny little components, I would imagine that they've got a basic DSLR with a really good macro lens, and that's it. If you have the lighting on point, then you know, even a phone camera would be taking much, much better photos. In fact, I wonder if I pull up one of their full-size images. This probably won't work. But then if I look in the properties on that image, nah, it's already been too compressed and it's on the web. Yeah, it's not going to have the metadata in there. Nah, okay. I was going to try and like do some sleuthing. It doesn't matter. Anyway, they use a good camera, but their lighting is incredible. Just beautiful. Okay. So, Dave Burns, so I'm just trolling, eh? No, you were very helpful in helping me remember the word light box. So I guess I have to say you are not just a troll. You're my troll, but you're not just a troll. just to kind of wrap us up, and we can get into some Q&A here. We can talk about some some other tech stories if there's anything that I've missed, or if there are other gadget announcements or releases that you want to highlight. I want to spend a little time here. I did the reaction stream to the Microsoft announcement like a half hour after that announcement finished, and then TK and I, we did our own a major topic for the last episode of Best of Our Week was also the Microsoft announcement. I just want to spend a little bit of time here to recap. I can get rid of Dave Burns' message on the live stream there. I want to spend a little time to recap the Surface Duo Dos. The joke that we came up with Best of Our Week is I've got to find a way to... I want to find a better DOS emulator so I can talk about the Surface Duo Dos running DOS. Because that's just going to be way too much fun to say. Yes, this is... The announcement of a new Surface Pro, the Surface Pro 8, which is looking really clean. There's the new mouse. Oh, I don't have it on my screen very well. There we go. There's the new mouse, which is made out of, I think, 20% recycled ocean plastic. There's this crazy new swivel hinge Surface laptop, the Surface Laptop Studio, which can kind of fold flat or can fold like a traditional laptop. And this is I think this is going to be a Surface Book replacement. Some people are upset about that. Some people are excited about that. And of course, the Surface Duo 2 for my channel, I did put in a pre-order. I'm so sad. I'm actually kind of frustrated here. So Microsoft announces all this gear, and they say in the press conference, in the product reveal, and it's going to be available starting October 4. So I'm thinking, okay, they didn't say anything about pre-orders, though. So there's probably going to be just like a quick follow-up, maybe in the next couple days, maybe in time for the weekend, they're going to start announcing pre-orders. So I start up my live stream, and I start talking about all the products, and we're digging into all the specs, and I go into, like, let's see what this Duo is really going to cost. And I click it open, and the pre-orders have already been live, and they're basically all sold out. There's like one model, one of the 256 gig models was still available. And in like, you can actually see in that moment during the live stream, like, you know, watch people die inside. You know, like, I was ready to throw my credit card down. So unfortunately, I'm not on the bleeding edge of these pre-orders. My Surface Duo 2 will probably be arriving end of October. So I'm going to be way late to this conversation. But this is, again, it's something that I'm kind of getting as much for myself as I am for my YouTube clicks. And I'm looking to expand some of the conversation that we also have with the long-term follow-ups on the Patreon. And so I've been back spending a little bit more time with my Duo 1, which has just been a beautiful tablet experience to share. And I've got some concerns with Duo 2 over some of these hardware differences. Obviously, the camera bulge introduces a hardware-specific difference between these two devices that I'm going to be really anxious to try out. It impacts one of the ways that I liked using the Duo 1, and it might make the Duo 2 less good in an on-the-go kind of situation. From Slick Rick Moranis, I am thoroughly sold on the Microsoft Duo 2 so far, but as a NextDock 360 user with a Note 20 Ultra, the only thing that crushes me is the lack of a desktop mode. I know there is HDMI output, but I at least want to turn off the screen when I'm using the 360. I'm really feeling that this should be my next device, though, as it has everything else I need for my intensive needs. That is the main critical issue. You know what I think a lot of people could probably deal with? When you plug a Duo 1 into another monitor, it does pillar box. This is the wrong aspect ratio for a 16 by 9 monitor. So you get black bars on the sides of your 16 by 9 display. But the way that the Duo automatically split screens apps works really well on a desktop. It's like how you pin apps in Windows 10. So the immediate productivity actually kind of works without it having a full-fledged desktop mode. I wish it could resize to 16 by 9, but the biggie, and you've absolutely nailed it, Slick Rick Moranis, the issue I have is it keeps your phone screen on while you're using it to screen mirror. And I could deal with a much more simplified desktop layout if it would eventually either let me just time the screens out, or if I could use it while it was closed. So I plug it in, the screens never turn on, and it just becomes this little baby brain sending video to another display. I want that so bad on a Duo, because I think it would be very, very useful. I think it would be a really practical way to get a little bit more use out of this. And we've already seen, like, our pocket phones and our little pocket supercomputers are grossly overpowered for most of the phone things that we do on them. Sammy, I love it. So Sam was like my OG Duo buddy. Mine's on pre-order, the 256 gig Obsidian. Gorgeous. Simon says, Hypno, Surface Duo 2, how do I even begin to say that? Oh no, it's so hard figuring out name. That's what keeps consumers from buying Sony Xperias. Dustadore, I greatly appreciate that, because I am excited about this. If you're going to be late, we know you're going to be the best. You're going to bring the best wine, Juan. Yeah, when I show up to the party late, I definitely don't show up empty-handed. That was too many negatives in that. From Russ 9123, how would that 888 fare on that thin chassis? I have really come to the conclusion that the compute power of our current SoCs is not much of a benefit if we can't control it. Like, as a quick tangent, think of all of the people who are freaking out about iPhone 13 battery life. What's the big change? Apple didn't find any magic optimization. Apple didn't find any, sorcery to tweak the efficiency of a 5G modem. Apple just put in a bigger battery, like we've been screaming at Apple to do for years now. And if you saw, like, iPhone 12, we're optimizing 5G. We've got the hardware and the software synergy. We're working with all the carriers. We're going to do 5G right, except that they totally didn't. And that is all on the backs of iPhone 12 owners, many of whom, like, if they want better battery life, are probably just going to need to disable, 5G. And their big solution, oh, you know what will probably help is if we put in a bigger battery. Hey, that's a good idea, guys. So I had to tweet this last night because I've been seeing so many people like, oh my gosh, I got like 6 hours of screen on time and I still have 25% of my battery left. And you're like, I had an LG V60. My LG V60 routinely got 9 to 10 hours of screen on time, with at least half of that use being dual screen. So on a 5G capable phone running two discrete displays, I was getting 20 to 30% more screen on time with my use, which if I'm running dual display is often 2 to 3 apps at a time, than what we're currently getting on an iPhone. So this whole notion of optimization and power savings and blah, 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 techies have grossly disregarded the battery hit when we combine 5G with increasingly powerful SoCs and higher refresh rate displays. That trio is death to our batteries. So go talk to your family and friends and ask them, do you want a slightly crisper and smoother app drawer, or do you want legit 2 to 3 days of runtime? Because I think most people are going to say, hey, I'd rather have way more battery life. That's always going to be an issue. I always want that safety. I always want that security. I don't want to have to recharge it as many times to put additional wear and tear on the battery. I'm seeing like 5 to 7 hours of screen on time for iPhone 13s. Like, that's not that great. That really isn't for all of this praise that we're seeing on $1,000 plus phones. So short story, incredibly long and cranky, Russ. What I'm hoping is we see some of the more intense throttling on the 888 for this Surface Duo. It's running two displays. They're bumping it up to a 90 hertz refresh rate for each screen. It's a 5G phone. The battery is getting bigger, which is going to make it heavier. I don't know how to properly express this if you've never held a Duo. With it being so thin and so compact, it is incredibly light and skinny, making it easy to hold in nearly any orientation from either hand to accomplish whatever you need to do. It does make me a little anxious if this gets a bit thicker, because then it takes away from how sublime it is to use as a tablet, and it makes it a little bit more fatiguing to use out in the field. If I can't leave it in my pocket, totally screen out when I want to use it just as a single screen phone, that makes it a little less useful to me in the field. You know, like I've got to pull it out of my pocket and open it all the way up if I want to check into something real quick, because I can't leave it screen out because of a camera bulge. That makes it a little less useful to me. And it takes away from how good of a folding tablet it is to make it a less good phone. You know, like you're never going to convince someone that this is the true phone replacement. But if you make it a poorer tablet to make it a better phone, you haven't really made it a better device. From Simon Says Hypno. Lesser gooder is badder. That is true. I don't know that anything truer has ever been posted in the comments on one of my videos. And from Barry Johnson, who's had like really solid commentary, you definitely check out Engineer Reacts on YouTube. I love using the Duo in single screen mode. I'm praying that Duo DOS running DOS doesn't kill this. I mean, I really feel single screen mode is going to be fine, but I can't keep it that way. I can keep the Duo 1 in single screen mode in my pocket, and I don't think I'll be able to do that on the Duo 2. From Trey, I'm not gonna lie, Slick Rick Moranis is a dope ass name. It really is. From McCorkerin 3, this is definitely the obnoxious trend. I heard Microsoft isn't putting a charger in the box or a bumper, and I can confirm. I don't have the product yet. I'm gonna be getting the new Slim Stylus to go with it. That's gonna show up on the 4th. That's going to ship early. My actual Duo won't be here until the end of October. So I'll be able to show you the new stylus before then. But yeah, like every other manufacturer in the ludicrous conversation about protecting the environment, I guess, they are also kind of playing into the Apple game of not putting a charger in the box. So I think this is what's going to be kind of interesting. Gabaletta writes this comment here. Hold on, I'm going to read it from this side. Where did it go? I can't read. There it is. I was on the fence between the Duo 2 and the Z Fold 3. I ended up going with the Fold 3 because it gives me a phone, tablet, and one device. If I had gone with the Duo 2, I would have had to keep another device as my communicator. I wanted to reduce the amount of devices I carry around, and the Fold 3 can do that for me, at least so far. We'll see if it can hang with my workflow. It definitely changed up for the, because again, I haven't taken the Duo 1 out as often as I would have under different world and pandemic circumstances. But the thing I really liked about Duo 1, this is the thickness. Hold on, let me see if I've got, I mean, I can kind of show this opposite something like a V60. So let me take the V60 out of its bumper, just to be fair, even though I would always keep it in a bumper. And the combined thickness, it's so hard to do camera choreography like this. Come on, line them up, Juan. Be better at camera stuff. I think if I block, this is really hard. So the combined thickness of a phone like the V60, which is just a hair thicker, and my camera autofocus is terrible. Come on, Panasonic. I'm getting this done for you, and you're not helping me out here. But you can kind of glean. The combined thickness of both panels of a Duo is arriving at, you know, just maybe a fraction of a millimeter thicker than a standalone V60. Not a V60 in a dual display case, not a V60 in my little bumper case, but just the naked V60, which I would never take out into the field. So when I used the Duo in single screen, I believe this is a better phone than the outer display on a Fold 3. I'm not trying to make you feel bad about owning a Fold 3. I think there are very good reasons people might shop different devices. But when I use this kind of BlackBerry Passport style, it lives in my pocket with the screen out. Pull it out of my pocket, single screen, put it back in my pocket, single screen, and it's a very easily accessible phone experience that by it being sort of squarer and wider actually is, in my opinion, kind of a better, it's kind of a better single phone experience than an overly narrow and skinny outer display. And so that's what I'm anxious about losing on the Duo 2. Is that it'll live in my pocket like this with a camera bulge, and then I'll pull it out of my pocket, and to use it, I've got to open it and interact with it. And look at what's happening with my hands. Like, I'm now fully occupied in the management of this. And so Duo 1 against Fold 2, I still, even down to how crummy the camera is, if you compare it against the rear cameras on a Z Fold 2, I still think the Duo is a better actual mobile tablet productivity phone than the Z Fold 2 was. I got a lot of comments. I'm like way behind here. Do 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 do. Simon says no. I think your wrists will survive. Copycat. So did the Duo boast 180 hertz display? Because it's two screens at 90 hertz. That's how you do the math. From Pakistan, what was the excuse for not including 3.5 millimeter jack on the Duo 2? Too thin? Something glaring at the camera bulge. Okay, so we got to talk about camera bulges. The main body of the Duo 2 is only ballooning, like, I think less than 1 millimeter. And this is way too thin to build a reinforced connector for a headphone jack. And the Duo 2, even being just that tiny bit thicker, still going to be way too thin to build in a headphone jack. So I kind of got into it a little on another YouTuber's stream after the announcement, where it just really rubbed me the wrong way. I was watching someone else's stream. I was in their live chat, and it was just like nerd angst, you know, complaint after complaint. You know, why are they building this camera bulge? Microsoft should do better. They could totally make the cameras flush with the panel on the phone. And so I type out and I say, hey, you know, like, that's actually not physically possible. You you can't make that camera flush with this panel. The only way you could do that is if you made the Duo significantly thicker overall. It's not a problem of the camera, it's a problem of Microsoft's design being this incredibly skinny, this incredibly thin. And this, like, kind of set them off a little bit, that I was challenging their assertion that this could be done. You're like, how do you know? There's a camera on the front of the Duo 1. That's a flush camera. And you're like, yes, that is a flush camera because it's a much smaller image sensor and it's a selfie camera. And it doesn't have optical image stabilization. But how do you know? How do you know what sensor they're using? So I want to show you, again, I feel like this individual forgot who he was talking to when it came to cameras and optics. And I'm literally one of the only people in the tech space right now trying to break down these differences in any way that might be meaningful information. Someone says, like, oh, a Pixel camera sensor is too small compared to an iPhone. I call BS. You got to show a lot of work to demonstrate a significant advantage for how different these sensor sizes are. So let's break this down. For any individual who might be concerned about the camera bulge, first of all, we need to acknowledge that Microsoft has done something kind of incredible here. So I'm going to go into the Surface Duo 2 website. This is on Surface, from Surface.com, but Microsoft.com. And hold on, let me see. Let me go back into screen share here for just a second. All right, Surface Duo 2, two screens, limitless possibilities. Let's go down to tech specs, and let's see. I can make this just a little bit bigger so that the stream can kind of read it. I don't know if that helped tremendously, but the overall thickness here, the claimed thickness from Microsoft, oh, no, don't. I don't want to chat now. Go away. The overall claimed thickness is, are you kidding me? Stop it. Because I've expanded the screen, I'm floating over what would normally, okay, hold on. I've got to make this smaller again. Microsoft, you're failing at me talking about your product. No, thank you. God. All right. So the overall thickness is going to be around 5.5 millimeters. That is crazy thin for a phone. So what phones? Someone in the chat. Let's see if we can find one. What phone can you think of that has a totally flush rear camera sensor? Anyone? Any? So I was trying not to hit. So Trey, you're absolutely correct. What the problem was is I was actually trying to float my mouse cursor over the no chat. And the what you're seeing and what my formatting is for blowing Firefox up larger was the problem. So I had to minimize the screen. It's complicated. But yes, that made me look really silly and foolish. LG G8. I wonder, do I have an LG G8 kicking around that we could maybe check out the depth of a camera sensor? I'm pretty sure I do. But I gotta look for it. And I can kind of go off camera here for just a second. Do I have my G8? I honestly don't know where my G8 is. But you know what? We have a companion device that might work just as well. So, okay. Sorry, I know I saw G8 first, but the first one I could find is my V50. V50, gorgeous. Look at that. Totally flush. There is no bump. It is all one contiguous and continuous piece of glass. Now, one, you're going to compare a Duo 2 with that big camera bulge against a phone that has a flush rear sensor. Now, that can't be fair because the camera bulge is ginormous. We must be talking about different camera sensors. Except we're not. If we go into the tech specs, Microsoft tells us exactly how big this sensor is. So let's go to camera and video recording. Unlike Apple, we can really do the math on this. We've got a 12 megapixel sensor, an f1.7 aperture, which means we actually do need a slightly larger lens than some of the phones that have an f1.8 aperture. A 27 millimeter equivalent focal length doesn't really tell us what the lens actually is, but 1.4 microns with a dual pixel PDAF autofocus system and OIS. So the image sensor size, pixel size, and optical image stabilization capabilities are pointing us to a generation of camera sensor almost identical to what's in a phone like the LG G8, the Galaxy S10, and the LG V50. The LG V50 has a totally flush rear camera sensor. This phone is over 8 millimeters thick. So when we break down the Duo 2, we know the Duo 2 is going to have a main camera sensor, which is very similar to what we find on this generation of phones. It's right in line with a Pixel 5a. That is the camera sensor. This is such a well-known sensor size. It's the same size sensor that we see in an iPhone 12 Pro, the $1,000, the former $1,000 iPhone 12 Pro uses this camera sensor. Now, how do I know that we can't make those camera sensors flush? Because Microsoft has already made this smaller than or shallower than any other manufacturer we've ever seen. So this is an over 8 millimeter thick phone. We see a camera bulge on an iPhone. We see a camera module kind of stick out from a Pixel 5a. No one has ever made it thinner than 7 millimeters. So with the full camera bulge on the Duo 2, we are currently looking at the thinnest implementation of this camera sensor with optical image stabilization at this aperture. The math on this is really easy. The science on this is tremendously demonstrable. The examples that we have that we can point to, it's not that much thicker. We're talking about millimeters of difference here. Yes, it is. It is thicker than what we're going to see on a Duo. Again, like the thickness that we see, the Duo 1 is ever so slightly thicker closed than an LG V50 naked. That's the kind of tolerances that we're going to be working with. So I am not impressed when someone says, oh, they could totally have made it flush. We are approaching the limits of optical physics. We're not even working with one of the biggest camera sensors to also minimize the impact and the footprint on this kind of camera module. And so I tried to spell that out to them, and you know, I kind of took that personal when I was point blanked. You know, like, well, how do you know? How do you know what sensor's in there? It's like, because I actually pay attention to this stuff. And again, I never got the acknowledgement, like, oh, I guess Juan really knows what he's talking about. It was more like, oh, but I just mean, like, they could do something different. Maybe they should have made it a wedge or a different shape. And that's fine, because I agree. I mean, there are definitely some usability concerns with having such a thin gadget. Obviously, we should be concerned about the durability and the sort of longevity of a product like that. Totally get it. But let's not pretend that there's some magic that can make a flush camera sensor appear where no other manufacturer has ever hit it thinner.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch.
We know what sensor this is, or we know roughly what sensor this is. We know what these tolerances are. We know what this photo performance should resemble. Microsoft has a big challenge here because they're not using one of these larger 1 over 1.8 or 1 over 1.7 sensors. They're not using a fancy pixel binning sensor. So their direct competition for camera hardware here is a Pixel 5a. And the Pixel 5a is a phenomenal point and shoot camera system. It really is not just good for the price. It is absolutely brutally competitive for most of your point and shoot scenarios against substantially more expensive phones. And now that's the same hardware that Microsoft is going to rock against a very well-established player with years of training on algorithms and post-processing. That's a tough fight. That's a really tough fight. I don't know that the addition of having like a flex mode, you know, like on a Pixel, I've got to find a stand or prop it up. If I want to on a Duo, I can just go merk and I can shoot, you know, directly from a Pixel. I mean, from a Duo, that kind of a setup. That's going to be a perk. That's going to be a draw. But we're not going to be able to directly compare this against, you know, again, similarly priced phones that have significantly larger camera sensors. It's going to be a different conversation. And it's something techies continuously try to gloss over. You know, again, the price of a Duo 2 is going to get you right in line with the most expensive tier of iPhone Pro 1 terabyte max, right? Oh, but you get a terabyte of storage on an iPhone. And you're like, yeah, but an iPhone is not this thin with hinges and the ability to fold in half. I mean, you can fold an iPhone in half once, but then you're pretty much done. So it can't be, you know, one spec. Oh, this camera, oh, that's not worth it because it's got a smaller camera sensor. We need to test it. We need to see if the camera is going to be good. You can get more storage on an iPhone. Yeah, but an iPhone can't fold in half. Oh, but, you know, the screens are in the display. Okay, what other device has stylus support? I mean, again, all of these things contribute to a price. And like, as soon as you add hinges to a phone, you're looking at least $1,000. So that's the game. I don't know how else to spell this out. Oh, it should have had more RAM. I mean, the Duo does two things at once. Why doesn't it have 16 gigabytes of RAM? What apps are you using? I'm going through massive spreadsheets on all of like my benchmarking and running videos or games from dual display phones like the Duo 1. Where can you properly demonstrate? Because I don't want to disagree with you. You might be right. I would like to know. Where would 50% more RAM really impact the day-to-day experience when two apps are up and active at the same time? Because you're already a step ahead of the curve for how most people are going to use a traditional candy bar phone. This encourages split-screen multitasking in ways that normal Android phones don't. So what apps are you using that are already going to take up 6 gigabytes of RAM? Because I can think of a couple games, but are you running two games at the same time? I don't think you are. So I want us to be critical. I think that's necessary. I want us to look at like the ergonomics of what made Duo 1 special, share some of our concerns over what might not be as nice on Duo 2, But I am absolutely not impressed with this magical, they should have done this different kind of thinking. Again, we're going to see something that has literally never been accomplished before. It's already thinner than any other competing solution we've ever seen before. I feel like that deserves credit, not complaint. And the complaints hinging on magical thinking that cannot exist is going to make me increasingly combative. I will show up in your live stream to say, hey, you're getting this wrong. You're basically telling your audience, you don't understand cameras. You don't know how tech works. Here's the right information you might want to utilize. So Simon says, Hypno, TCL 10 Pro, different camera sensor, larger camera sensor, thicker phone, no optical image stabilization. So you can balance the larger sensor against that lens assembly if you don't need to incorporate anything that wiggles the camera sensor in the lens assembly. You can shave a little bit of depth off of that, but a TCL 10 Pro, I'm not going to be able to find that 10 Pro. It's buried in there right now. But again, TCL 10 Pro is roughly in league, a little bit thinner than the full thickness of like a V50, but you don't save much. So again, there can be some of those conversations happening. Like if we use a much larger camera sensor, we probably don't need as much help from optical image stabilization, just like we saw in the OnePlus 9. A OnePlus 9 with a bigger sensor and no OIS, I think is a much more consistent shooter in low light than a Galaxy S21 with a smaller sensor, but larger camera bulge to include optical image stabilization. So you can pick and choose some of those different elements. It's not all just one thing, but if we're looking at this size sensor, this size aperture, kind of understanding the size of the lens, and OIS, we've never seen it done thinner. And it's exceedingly rare that we can point to phones with that exact hardware combination that had totally flush sensors. Someone else also pointed out, like when I brought that up before, like the Nokia 9 has totally flush camera sensors. And it's got 5 camera sensors and they're all totally flush. But those were even smaller. I believe they're either 1 over 2.8 or 1 over 2.9. So the sensors on the Nokia 9 are closer in size to most selfie cameras than they are to the rear camera on like a Pixel 5. But you make up for that for the light acquisition and the computational photography of having multiple sensors all combining image data into one. Let's see. People are asking what camera I'm using now. I'm using one of my Lumix. This is the G9. But the NVIDIA broadcast software doesn't like it when I kind of mess around too much, like looking down and trying to pick up. The autofocus on Panasonic still sucks. Even when I'm trying to like work it, and it's just a mess. I mean, really what I should just do is keep it stuck on my face and just do like the face focus and then just deal with everything else being blurry and out of focus. Gabaletta, this is totally true. This is the same reason why Samsung doesn't use the top of the line cameras on the Fold. The thickness on the Z Fold 3 is 6.2 millimeters opened. Imagine having that huge sensor on that S21 Ultra slapped on the back of the Fold, that camera bump would have been massive. And so again, I feel like you can't borrow the extra depth to minimize the sensor bulge without making the Fold extremely fatiguing to use. The 1 millimeter of depth difference between the Z Fold 3 and the Surface Duo 2 is gonna be felt. You're going to feel that difference in thickness. So just the argument that, well, they could just make both panels on the Duo even thicker, makes the Duo harder to use. So do you want to sacrifice the core usability of such a fun little book of a phone to get a slightly less protruding camera bulge. And I would say, no, I don't want that. I want this to be the utterly usable folding tablet experiment that I came to love from the first Duo. And from Dust to Dora, wouldn't a wedge change the way you would use the hinge? It would. But I still would love to see someone make a bumper case. I don't want it to be manufactured into the phone, but I want a bumper case that has a slight kind of V shape so that when you set it down on a table, it ever so slightly kind of V's the setup, but it stays flush. Like, I love when I set down the Duo 1, it is a perfectly flat slate. It does not wobble or rock on a table. And if we're going to have a camera bulge, I would want the rails to properly support both sides of the phone so that it's kind of V-shaped. And I can still do like all of my writing and stuff. It would still kind of feel like a book. Like if you ever open up a little Moleskine and you're writing in it, it never lays perfectly flat. It always has like a little bit of a kind of a bump or a shape to it. And then when you open it all the way around, instead of resting against the camera module, you would have that V shape kind of pressing more evenly along the entire border of both screens. It would definitely make it a little chunkier, but I think that would maybe be safer if I ever needed to just put it in a pocket as with the screens open and out. I think a V shape case would be great. And it would also help kind of protect the panels if the phone takes a tumble. It's less likely it would land hard on one. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to like actually punch in front of the mic that hard. It would land, it would probably protect the hinges a little bit better. I'd love to see someone kind of print, you know, like maybe 3D print a wedge slide-on bumper case like that. I think it would be a big benefit for the Duo. Simon says, Hypno, OG Duo pictures aren't that bad. Not flagship, certainly, but nowhere near as bad as reviewers said. They got better. So the camera in its initial state was rough. I mean, I think that's totally fair. A lot of the software on the Duo was a challenge to use at the very beginning because Microsoft is genuinely making Android do things that Android can't do. But over time, I thought it got a lot better. And the Duo became one of the best selfie cameras I think we had access to here in North America. It's just you would also have to question, can you really get all your photography done from a selfie camera? There are some people who will say yes to that. Predominantly, the camera they use the most is the selfie camera. They're taking pictures of themselves, right? People like me, it's a bit more of a stretch because I would like to use it to produce content and even just down into the silly differences, like when you hold the phone in one orientation for rear camera and you flip the phone around for the other orientation for selfie camera, the algorithms that process that data are different. And that would drive me crazy. Like even in how it sort of did its electronic image stabilization, the software stabilization was different from side to side. And that's the kind of stuff that just irked me. It wasn't necessarily that the cameras were bad, because it's a fine selfie camera. It was that I wanted the processing in from one direction to be the same in both directions, and I couldn't get that. Do. There are a ton of comments here. From Sammy. Shane Craig, scary if literal, ran two instances of PUBG at the same time. Not enough RAM? Huh? So I didn't do anything silly with gaming. The hardest game I think I hit my Duo with. No, I did play Undead Horde. Eventually the screen rotation worked so I could play the 10 tons games. But the game that I started showing sort of the processing power, it was cranking Doom 3 60 frames per second. I loved that. So if you get Delta Touch and you get the Doom 3 game files, you can play Doom 3 natively on, I would say, anything kind of Snapdragon 855 or up at like a beautifully consistent 60 frames per second. I mean, like, when Doom 3 came out, my PC could not run Doom 3 as well as my Surface Duo could. So I am not impressed with these arguments that, oh, you need more processing power. For what? I'm not saying you're wrong, but tell me where it would help. Because I feel too many reviewers are incapable of properly demonstrating that. Juan, your composition skin makes me want to keep... let's try that again from Trey. Juan, your composition skin keeps wanting to send me to some only Juan's website. This is just the coolest look. I'm gonna have to see if they make one for the Duo 2. As soon as I get the Duo 2, I've got to find this or what was the other one that I saw? Someone had made a mock-up of a skin for the Duo 2 that was the handbook of the recently deceased from Beetlejuice. And like, if I can find someone who will actually print that, I might need to get that, because that's so nerdy. I kind of need that in my life. From Trey, tech reviewers are always so hyperbolic about cameras. I remember back in the HTC One days, I was saying that all these phones are in the 95th percentile of smartphone cameras, but you're treating them like only the best one is worth it. Is worth anything, while the least good of the best is absolute garbage. So increasingly, not only... So Trey, I completely agree with you. And increasingly, not only is that true, I'm increasingly doubtful of most tech reviewers' ability to explain or demonstrate differences. I think it's insufficient. And I'm not really trying to call anyone out here specifically, but it's something that I see fairly regularly. So again, here, let me kind of mock this up. Like, I've got a OnePlus 9, and this has a significantly larger image sensor, excuse me, than a phone like my Pixel 5a. But we're still talking about cell phone cameras. So the image sensor on this is an order of magnitude smaller than the Micro Four Thirds sensor that's in my mirrorless camera, which is substantially smaller than the image sensor that goes into a full-frame camera like a Sony A7, right? So we're so many tiers smaller than a nice top-of-the-line mirrorless camera that we kind of understand as having a really photographic and a really cinematic look to the content that it produces. So if we compare these two phones, the output from both of these phones is going to look so similar to each other against a mirrorless camera like my Micro Four Thirds or a mirrorless camera like the Sony, right? We should very easily be able to see differences between my G9 and a Sony A7. It would be much, much more difficult to demonstrate that continuity of sensor size differences from phones directly compared against those mirrorless options. The physics of this matters. But if we're highlighting the specific differences between these two phones, we should be able to demonstrate how those differences manifest. But I don't think the current flavor of average consumer commentary can demonstrate that. So if you go out and it's a nice bright sunny day and you take two photo samples, like you put these in cradles side by side, and you set up like one stick so you can hold both phones kind of a V shape as I drop my Pixel 5. Thankfully, I've got carpet. Gotta reach. Thanks, NVIDIA Broadcast, for smoothly panning down to showcase my embarrassment there. First of all, that's a terrible way to compare footage side by side. Every photographer will inevitably highlight one framing over the other. if you put two cameras next to each other, they're not capturing the same scene. And you will have those micro differences in metering, in focus, in how the lens and focus fall off work. It's very similar to like when you focus and recompose. Like you have a really nice standalone camera and you focus in one specific area, but you've got to angle the camera slightly, you're going to fall off the focus point if you're not very careful with focus and recompose. So look at some of these side-by-side comparisons. You'll see the two cameras side-by-side. So that's fair. You're getting the same shot, but you're totally not. Your field of view, those changes, those differences, these have different equivalent focal lengths, so you're seeing different scenes. You're not framing them the same way, which means you're probably inadvertently framing for one phone and not the other. So you frame on like the phone you're more familiar with, you end up taking the better photo from that phone, and then you just push the shutter in a compromised angle on the other phone. The only way to do this, and it's very difficult, is to try and match the frame. So you take the shot and you really look at how your subject or your scene is laid out, and then you very carefully try to swap the phone to match what you see from the first phone, focusing in exactly the same spot, exactly the same angle. It is not easy. It takes so much longer to do that right. You do this and you set up both phones so they're both shooting the same video. It's not the same video. You do not have the same framing. You do not have the same focus. You do not have the same metering. You are not properly demonstrating the differences between these two devices. You're highlighting one device over another. And this kind of keeps compounding. We praise, like, oh, bigger image sensors, that's what you need. All this computational photography, it doesn't get the job done. But then you go and show the exact scenes where computational photography on a smaller sensor does actually produce a better image. You go out in really bright daylight conditions and you shoot a really nicely lit scene, the differences between these two devices are going to be impossible to practically measure. Like, you're not going to be able to see them very effectively. So when we talk about larger sensors, we're talking about better light acquisition, lower light capabilities, down into super, super dark conditions. We're talking about a shallower depth of field. This stuff does contribute to the look and feel of your photos. But that's not how tech reviewers are showing this. If it's just like a slideshow of side by side, I took a bunch of samples and you tell me which one you liked better down in the comments. Chances are pretty good you've unintentionally rigged your comparison for one phone to win. So that's kind of the frustration I've got. Again, and to Trey's point, you know, now it's a sliding scale of iPhone to terrible, right? We're sort of now just generally accepting that iPhones have to bestest cameras, which really hasn't been demonstrated. There's no practical demonstration of iPhones having the best cameras. And if you care about a shallower depth of field, cinema mode is fun, but doing it optically with a larger sensor is better. So you've got to actually show your work. And I feel too many people don't. You know, like, I want to highlight, like, the good work. I mentioned him in a podcast, I think last week I even brought him up again. When it comes to kind of staging that side-by-side or that comparative photo performance, I really like the way that Nick Gray does it. Because I don't think he's trying to make any specific claim. He's not trying to say one phone is better than the other. And I think he does a little bit better work at reframing per phone as opposed to just lazily sticking two phones side by side. And he does. He does talk about and showcase a more average consumer-y kind of setup. But then he gets to the end of one of those comparisons and he's not claiming that somehow, even though you couldn't see it from any of his samples, that one phone was better. You know, like, he's not going to just pan a Pixel because it has a smaller image sensor. He's shown you all of these photos, like things he's actually done with his family. And like, could you see the differences? Because on a YouTube video, you probably couldn't. Ah. Oh, Dustadori, I still remember you losing the, I still remember the sadness of you losing your Samsung camera. The NX30 was so much fun. I hated, it killed me when that sensor guard cracked and I got that big old weird shadow cutting through my frame. And I was still so angsty. Like, there's a part of me that still wishes I had decided to get an NX1 instead. It's just so expensive. And it was a dead platform. Ah, it just killed me. Sorry, I'm way behind on the chat, so. Can the Duo run Crysis? I need to see if there's a way to port it over, but I actually wouldn't be surprised if it did it okay. Sammy, I would rock the hell out of that Beetlejuice skin. Yup. And this is kind of the main point. Most cameras are so good that unless you are pixel peeping and doing side-by-side comparisons, you really can't tell. I think you can. So from Momicon, again, the main point that I want to try and illustrate is I will spend as much money as I can to get the better image sensor because I'm trying to drive phone photography and phone video harder. If you don't have the need or the want, then your style of photography is right in line with what these last generation smaller image sensors were designed to do and do very, very well. But when it comes to things like shallower depth of field, one of the best ones that I love to demonstrate, and I have this in that video that I put out a little while back, like talking about camera upgrades. If I do a night mode photo from a pixel, the quality of that photo is determined by how long I can hold still. And in really, really dark scenes, I've had some pixels go out to like 10 seconds for capturing all of the light that they need because of the size of that image sensor. If you pick up a phone with a larger sensor, like a OnePlus 9 Pro, or moving up even a little bit bigger to something like a Galaxy S21 Ultra or a Xiaomi Mi 11 Ultra, what would take a pixel 8 to 10 seconds to capture can be captured on a OnePlus 9 in 2 to 3 seconds. So the quality of your photo improves because even with all of the computational gyro stabilization, blah, 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 you literally just hold the phone for less time. There's less time for you to shake and smear that photo. So if you're taking a lot of night mode photos, there's a very tangible, practical benefit to stepping up to a larger image sensor. And I'm sure we're going to see that demonstrated on the Pixel 6 using a much larger image sensor than the one that's on the Pixel 5a. But if you're only occasionally trying to push the low light limits of a Pixel 5, it's not gonna make much of a difference to you. Okay, so yeah, I've got to hold still for 8 seconds here. Okay, but I'm doing that like maybe once every couple of months. You know, like you're not gonna get the benefit of that larger sensor. From Russ, the problem is not that I don't want a Duo, it's just not available here, and money helps. Yeah, that's a pretty big gotcha on trying to pick up a Duo. Yeah, Dave Burns, we've definitely covered that one too. Reviewing on YouTube for a lot of consumer sectors has gotten really lazy. And again, if you're gonna make claims, Dave Burns from when I was mentioning him, Nick Gray, Aditi Anil properly correcting me or contributing. If you would like to see Nick Gray's work, you would go to Fandroid, Phandroid, Fandroid.com. He resurrected that site and does phenomenal work. He's a good buddy. I genuinely adore the kind of content, and the family focus on his content is very refreshing. And I love that even when he's doing kind of the algorithm, like phone comparison, I like that his style of comparison seems to be a little less hyped. There's a little less of, there's less of the feeling that he's going into this with an expectation that the most popular phone is going to win. And he's always I love like when he kind of finds some of those surprises, like, oh yeah, I was expecting this and then this happened. And then look at these photos and look at these videos. Yeah, I really like the way that he puts his content together. Paul Puri, the best camera is the one that you have on you. That's absolutely true. But I also would like to add, if you would like to push the boundaries on your phone photography and your phone video, there are reasons why someone might want to spend more and get bigger sensors. But again, you as the photographer have to want that. You don't just get better photos because the hardware changes. That's not how this works. And you could also maybe do a little reading and studying, like maybe check out this amazing book on Amazon Kindle called Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs, where you'll get some technical articles about different camera sensors. You'll get a breakdown on different styles of photography, ways to inspire better photography. I hear it's a really good book and maybe worth checking out. All right, I'm kind of catching back. Simon says, if no, beat me to it. Beat me to my own joke. If only there was a book about smartphone photography. Oh, that's hilarious. And from Paul Puri, I have to learn how to use my camera. What was all that auto BS? Yes, unfortunately, the photographer still matters when it comes to photography. Folks, we've run this podcast a lot longer than I intended to, and especially with kind of the rambling on photo and camera stuff. It really did. I had that like Michael Jordan moment. So like, how do you know what sensor is in there? So I took that kind of personal. And I left a wall of text in his live chat, but I feel it's something worth us continuing to discuss, that you know, it's worth getting the stuff right. If we're going to say that we can critically analyze consumer electronics, we at least need to know what's like literally physically possible. If our expectations drift to the impossible, then we are not doing a good job of critically comparing and analyzing these products. Like, I would like this if it were impossible, is not a good way to frame a gadget review. So, on that note, we should probably kind of wrap all this up here. Folks, I've got a lot on my plate, but thankfully, some of it will be concluding this week. So there should be some fun videos, some fun camera samples, maybe conversations about different kinds of mobile photography and mobile video production. I've got some audio kit that's going to be pretty rad to showcase. I've got a killer laptop review that's going out tomorrow. Like, if you wanted the RoboCop of laptops, that's the gig that we're going to be playing with. This is going to be a busy week. And I feel confident, like kind of calling my shot here, that I'll be properly in the top five for reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles. I think something's gonna hit. I think one of these is really gonna land well, and we'll see. We'll see how it lines up. Russ is asking if I'm gonna get the Pixel 6. I'm absolutely gonna get a Pixel 6. I don't know when exactly, because we don't know when it's really gonna launch, but that is on the list of must review phones for me. So, folks, I want you to have a fantastic week. Be sure to check out all of this, the streams, all of the content, all of the videos. Please support that subreddit. Drop me those comments on what we want to do for the live stream for our pizza party for the Glowing Rectangle subreddit. Man, this is exciting stuff.
Anyone who's acting like the only thing that's exciting to talk about are like iPhone 14 rumors is very bad at tech, because we've got cool gear all around us right now. That's what's going to get us lit up. Really using this stuff now is way more exciting than just dealing with stupid leaks and rumors. So thank you so much for tuning in, for joining this amazing live chat, for contributing, for sharing and supporting. All of that, it means the world to me. And it's these kinds of conversations that I love really chewing into. So I want you to have an amazing week. I want you to do awesome with your technology. I want you to be awesome with your technology. And I'll catch you all back here for another episode of the Monday Morning Tech Chat Show on the SDGQA podcast channel. Take care. Be well. Really, take care of yourselves, both physically and mentally and digitally. And I'll catch you back. I love y'all.
Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.